Good morning. This is Mary, and I'll be reading selections from the Pantograph from Monday, June 29th, 2026. From the front page of the Monday paper, Arts and Entertainment. Home embraces art and wonder. Sculpture-filled house on Garling opens for Airbnb guests. By Matus Janik, Bloomington. Visitors moved through steel, sculpture, and sound Saturday as Tom Kirk opened the House on Garling once again, this time as the art-filled Bloomington home prepares for its next role as an Airbnb. The transformed home at 1905 Garling Drive opened to the public Saturday with live music by local singer-songwriter and guitarist John Till. For Kirk, the weekend open house marked another step in the evolution of a home that has become part residence, part sculpture, and part public curiosity. After years of adding industrial materials, handmade features, and functional art to the property, he is preparing for space for overnight guests to stay inside what he describes as an art sculpture. "You know, I want them to feel welcome," Kirk said of visitors seeing the house for the first time. "I want them to feel what it took to do this. I want them to be able to appreciate the time that it takes to accomplish a feat like this." The Airbnb plan has forced Kirk to rethink a space that's once served as his family's home. He said he now thinks of the house in two parts, an entertainment side, where the immersive art environment is centered, and a guest side, where overnight accommodations are being prepared. "That way, the way that we lived in it, my family and I, is different than the way I've had to present it to people that are coming here," Kirk said. "We had to make sure that they had bedding and everything, and we just had to make it a little softer than when we lived here." The work also included safety changes. Kirk said he spent nearly a year closing in railings, leveling steps, and making other adjustments before opening the house to overnight guests. "You're inside of an art sculpture," Kirk said. "You need to be careful in here. There's a lot of head bumps." The House on Garling has been years in the making. In January, Kirk hosted another open house in conjunction with the release of The House on Garling, a documentary made by Illinois State University students that explored the home's transformation, Kirk's story, and the themes of healing, growth, and creativity. At that time, Kirk said 40 new sculptures represented the final additions to the House on Garling. But on Saturday, he said finished is a complicated word. "I hear that all the time. Oh, it'll never be done. And I hope that it is never done. As long as I'm alive and breathing, I would like to come in and make little changes." John Apps, a longtime friend and collaborator, has watched the project develop and helped with handrails, fabrication, and brainstorming. He said many of the house's largest components were already in place before the building around them took shape. "He built all this stuff here and then built the house around it," Apps said. For Apps, the appeal is in the reactions. Visitors notice different things, whether it is a handrail, a huge bucket, a piece of fabrication, or the overall feeling of the place. "That's the best part, is seeing people's reactions," Apps said. "Everyone sees something that they like." He described the house as controlled madness, with a mix of planning and improvisation. "Sometimes you've got this master plan, and other times a treehouse," App said. "It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be straight. It just has to be there." Jeffrey Bass, an artist who grew up in the neighborhood, met Kirk after driving past the property about 10 years ago and seeing him working in the yard. To Bass, the house on Garling does not feel like a traditional home. "It's an art installation to me," Bass said. "It's like being swallowed by a giant piece of art." Bess said some people have questioned whether a project like Kirk's belongs in a residential neighborhood, while others like the contrast between the house and the surrounding ranch homes. Over time, he said, the project has become more accepted. The further he goes along, the more it's accepted, and the more people really, really enjoy it, Bess said. Don Hart, who previously lived in Bloomington Normal, said he and his wife had seen the house from the outside and watched it develop over time. Walking through the space Saturday, he was struck by the way Kirk uses materials that might otherwise be discarded. This is kind of like macro art in a way, Hart said, taking things that you wouldn't normally consider to be art and forming it in such a way as to show texture. Aaron Wolf, one of the ISU student filmmakers behind the documentary, said the house stands out because it is unlike what people usually encounter in daily life. It's just so out of the ordinary, Wolf said. It's something entirely different from our everyday lives. It just immediately raises questions to anyone driving by or seeing it. It's like an anomaly. Wolf said he sees the house much like Kirk does, not as a collection of separate objects, but as one larger work that continues to change. I almost consider the little house to be one piece, the same as Tom, Wolf said. Every time I walk through here, there's something new. For Kirk, the house is also tied to his own healing. He said he is comfortable speaking with visitors about the role the project played in his life, including his experience with depression and anxiety. I enjoy being like, well, hey, by the way, I've had really bad depression, anxiety, but I was still able to do this, Kirk said. This place healed me, 100%. The house on Garling also points toward Kirk's larger ambitions for Bloomington's art community. In January, Kirk discussed his plans for a new build and his work in the warehouse district south of downtown Bloomington, where he has developed 410 Sculpture Park and has begun a broader city museum project. As for his place in the local arts community, Kirk said he wants to create space for others. I would just like to put myself as an anchor where I can have other people come in to share, display, create, or just simply feel comfortable, Kirk said. There were a number of photos with this article, of course, and it's kind of hard to describe. One of them is Don Hart walking through the house during an open house and showing some of the industrial materials and handmade sculpture and functional art that are within. Mr. Hart appears to be walking on a trail and is surrounded by all sorts of metalwork and chains and what appears to be perhaps a decorated old refrigerator. The bedroom area from inside the Airbnb portion is shown in a photo, and the bed appears to be attached to a large piece of metal. One has to climb up to get into the bed. The headboard of the bed appears to have some sort of light fixtures on it. And then there's a round circle. I don't know if it's big enough for a person to go through or not, or if you have to crawl through it, that appears to be going into another room. On the front page of the paper it's painted from the outside. There's a giant, all kinds of giant sculptures on the outside. And then what appears to be maybe the home section of it is painted purple. It has huge windows with green stripes around the window panes, cartoon figures drawn along the sides and along the bottom on the purple area. It's really hard to describe. It would be very interesting, I think, to be able to go into that house and see what exactly they're talking about. Also on the front page from the Monday paper, Bloomington, All of Us 250 rally centers on civil rights by Matus Janik. Bloomington. Despite the weather, Olenka Moss said showing up Saturday meant standing in for people who could not safely be there themselves. Community presence is essential, said Moss, who is the founder and head organizer of Blow No Helps. It's imperative for mobilization, awareness, education, and for morale. Moss was one of among the speakers and attendees who gathered Saturday on the south lawn of the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts for Bloomington Normal 50501's All of Us 250 rally. The event was held in recognition of the 250th anniversary of the United States, with speakers using the approaching Independence Day milestone to call for democracy, civil liberties, immigrant rights, LGBTQ+ rights, and continued local organizing. We need to be present for community members, all those who are unable to be here today, Moss said. We want to represent them as well, and those who have chosen not to be here for their safety. We want to represent them as well. Saturday's event came on a drizzly afternoon, but speakers framed the weather as secondary to the political movement. Bloomington Normal 50501 organizer and spokesperson Lily Linden opened the rally by saying those who gathered were there because they refused to comply. We have a choice about the story to tell, Linden said. While they try to plan a whitewashed and discriminatory celebration of our independence, we will not sit back and let strong men, politics, and corruption define the moment. Linden said the rally was about helping define the future of our country and of our community through people joining together across race, gender, identity, culture, and economic lines. We are out here today to help define the future of our country and of our community as one of people coming together, about people joining forces to defend democracy and our rights and build a future rooted in people, not kings and authoritarian leaders, Linden said. Carol Coos, president of the Central Illinois chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, connected the rally's message to the Declaration of Independence. In just a few days, we will celebrate the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, which was adopted on July 4, 1776, Coos told attendants. Coos said the declaration was enacted in response to the tyranny of King George III and emphasized individual rights and the government's role in protecting them. Many of those grievances resonate with the political issues of today, such as government overreach and disregard for laws, Coos said. Accordingly, the themes of tyranny and the fight for rights remain relevant today. Coos said the anniversary was not a moment for us to give up. Instead, it's time for us to get involved, she said. Coos pointed to the ACLU's court fights over immigration policy, diversity, equity and inclusion programs, free speech, and free expression. But she said the responsibility cannot rest only with organizations. As individuals, each of us must continue to use our speech and expression to make clear the sort of society we as individuals want to build, Coos said. That can include attending protests, speaking out, engaging elected officials, joining organizations, and volunteering, she said. Coos also urged people to vote and protect voting access for every eligible voter. I am hopeful today that we can fight together and retrieve our democracy, she said. That hope is entered in the presence of each of you here. For Moss, the rally was also an opportunity to speak about Blow No Helps, a mutual aid initiative she described as serving Bloomington Normal, several nearby counties, and even communities in other states. Moss said the group has done mutual aid runs to Minneapolis and St. Paul, and locally provides help, including hygiene kit deliveries, grocery assistance, and support for the unhoused population. Basically, wherever there's help or a bridge that needs to be built, Blow No Helps is there to assist, Moss said. Moss said she came to the rally to speak about the organization and show solidarity with our community. Bree Byers, 29, of Bloomington, co-president of the Queer Coalition at Illinois State University and founder of Twin City Trans Femmes, told the crowd that the fight for LGBTQ plus equality has always been an uphill battle. But to say it is a dire time for trans people, specifically right now, would be an understatement, Byers said. Byers said transgender people are being pushed farther out of public life, losing access to medical care, and facing violence. She criticized politicians who, she said, are willing to abandon trans people when advocacy becomes politically difficult. We need committed allies who earn the title, not power seekers looking to tokenize us as proof of their so-called progressivism, Byers said. Byers said policy change alone would not immediately address the conditions many transgender people face. If all anti-trans legislation disappeared tomorrow, that wouldn't alleviate the more immediate consequences of our marginalization, Byers said. She spoke about transgender people struggling to find jobs, struggling to find housing, food, medication, saying material conditions must be improved first and foremost. Andrew Franzen, 20, said he attended as an independent organizer and member of Bloomington Normal 50501's Leadership Council. Franzen said rallies like Saturday's event give people a place to exercise their First Amendment rights and see that others share their concern. The people are upset, Franzen said. They're very upset with how things are going. For Franzen, local organizing is connected to broader movements across the state and country. The community doesn't just end at the city limits of Bloomington Normal, Franzen said. It goes beyond. It goes to the county. It goes to the state. It goes to the national level. A July 4th rally is planned at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts from noon to 1:30 p.m. Another 50501 rally, themed Good Trouble Lives On, is planned for July 18th. Turning to page 2 of today's paper, today's flick fact. Today's question. In the Greenbrier subdivision in Northeast Normal, just south of Sam's Club, the streets are named for U.S. presidents. Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, Herbert Hoover, William Howard Taft Drives. Yet in the middle of all of these presidential namesakes is Jacobson Drive. Was there ever a President Jacobson? Today's answer, no. Clarence Jacobson was the owner of the farmland that was developed into the Greenbrier subdivision in the late 60s and 70s. How time flies. 100 years ago, June 29th, 1926, first bricks were laid at the Daily Pantographs model home in Briarwood Addition. Yesterday, the men made good progress during the day, and many rows of neat face bricks were set on the concrete base last night. Bricklaying work will continue all this week, and next week, the crew of carpenters will start their labors. 75 years ago, June 29, 1951, this month marks the 50th anniversary of the establishment of Walgreens drug stores. Bloomington Normal's interest in Walgreens goes beyond the fact that a Walgreens store has been operated here since 1927. Mr. Walgreens' widow is the former Myrtle Norton of Normal. 50 years ago, June 29th, 1976, Bloomington is tightening up its liquor ordinances to leave no doubt that minors can be charged with illegally entering a tavern. And to tavern owners, the city will be conveying the simple message, when in doubt, card. 25 years ago, June 29, 2001, Laborers International has filed a petition with the State Labor Relations Board to represent the 13 workers in Normal's water distribution division. City Manager Mark Peterson said the town was notified this week and has 7 days to submit a list of names, social security numbers, and job classifications for each of the employees. The two sides then begin discussing the composition of the proposed bargaining unit, he said, adding a point of contention often is whether supervisory workers should be included. Turning to the sports section and Section B, Plenty of Thoughts from Current Events in Sports by Paul Sullivan, Chicago Tribune. 12 Takeaways from the Summer of Love and Soccer. History lesson. Cubs president Jed Hoyer has never seen a rash of pitching injuries like the 2026 team has suffered. This is clustering something I've never really experienced, especially different injuries, a couple elbows, a couple hamstrings, a neck, a knee, Hoyer said. Someone get Hoyer a Cubs history book. In 1985, the entire Cubs rotation went down with injuries. Rick Sutcliffe, hamstring tear and strained adductor. Dick Ruthven, broken toe. Steve Trout, elbow inflammation. Dennis Eckersley, shoulder soreness. And Scott Sanderson, elbow. When Sutcliffe went on the disabled list for the third time on July 29th, GM Dallas Green said, "Nobody is going to deal with us to help us now. They've got us down. They're going to kick you when you're down. Besides that, there's a threat of a work stoppage. People are afraid to deal." Funny how history repeats itself. Hosts with the most. The world's Yelp reviews on America are in, and we're getting 4-star ratings from everywhere. The invading army of World Cup tourists love the hospitality, barbecue, ranch dressing, bars, superstores, fast food, and our all-around coolness. The Scots have turned our cities into giant parties, and the Norwegians have made conga lines in our ballparks. It's heartening to know that we're not all hated after all. The only impression some of them have had about the U.S. comes from news stories about the government and their arrogant worldview. Americans have shown the world we're much better than our leaders. Hopefully, it's a lasting impression. Number 3, channeling the Bears. Looking forward to the Bears Hallmark Channel movie, which was revealed this week by coach Ben Johnson and tight end Colston Loveland. President and CEO Kevin Warren said teaming up with Hallmark Media will provide our club and our fans with the opportunity to grow together by creating a meaningful, special movie. No word on the plot yet, but don't be surprised if it's about a young couple who falls in love looking at the Christmas lights on State Street and winds up building their dream home in Northwest Indiana. Fist of Fury. Indiana Fever star Caitlin Clark continues to get knocked around in the WNBA, including getting a fist in the throat from Phoenix Mercury guard Alyssa Thomas, who only received a 1-game suspension and fine. Clark probably needs to read The Jordan Rules by Sam Smith's classic book on Michael Jordan and how he handled similar rough treatment by Detroit Piston goons Bill Laimbeer and Rick Mahorn. When Detroit started knocking me around, everyone started playing that way, so I'm not allowed the creativity in the half-court game as much, Jordan said at the start of camp in 1990. Jordan bulked up that offseason, and coach Phil Jackson installed a triangle offense. The Bulls went on to finally beat the Pistons in the 91 playoffs on their way to their first title, and never looked back. Time for an audible? After having failed to secure a trademark for Iceman, Bears quarterback Caleb Williams should just try to patent Ice Machine, Wizard of Ice, or Ice Ice Baby. Don't give up, Caleb. Party Planning Committee. When I asked Commissioner Rod Manfred last year if there were any contingency plans for the 2027 All-Star Game at Wrigley Field in case of a lockout, he smugly replied, "My plan is to make an agreement with the players and play the 27th season." But MLB's ludicrous demands show how little interest there is among the owners to try to avoid a lockout. That means the Ricketts should probably not bother planning any parties around an All-Star Game at Wrigley that could be postponed. Can the White Sox shock the world? If the Sox are serious about contending, they should become a prominent bidder for Detroit Tigers ace Tarik Skubal, instead of calling up prospects and employing bullpen days, as they've done so far. Location, location, location. The arch the Cubs are constructing to honor the 2016 champions and their other World Series winners is nice, but the champion's gate should have been placed at an entrance to the actual ballpark and not to Gallagher Way, which is basically used as an area for fans to bring kids who are too restless to sit and watch an entire ball game. The bleacher entrance at Waveland and Sheffield Avenues would have been a place for a more appropriate place for a welcoming gate. Clean machine. If we've learned anything from the World Cup, it's that the simple act of bringing trash bags and cleaning up your garbage after games should be replicated in every stadium of every sports team in North America. Thank you, Japan, for showing us the way. Turning to national and world news, the Digest. Pope Leo prays for quake victims' rescuers. Vatican City. Pope Leo expressed solidarity Sunday with people in Venezuela grappling with the devastating impact of twin earthquakes that struck the country earlier this week. I wish to express my closeness to the Venezuelan sisters and brothers affected by the recent earthquakes that caused numerous victims and injuries, the pontiff said in Spanish, before worshippers gathered for Sunday's Angelus prayer in Rome. The pontiff also expressed gratitude to rescuers and all those assisting Venezuelans in the aftermath of the disaster. EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaja Kallas said in a post on social media that the European Union mobilized $5.9 million in emergency assistance for affected communities in Venezuela. Colorado. Three firefighters were killed and two injured while responding to the Snyder wildfire burning along the Utah-Colorado border, the U.S. Wildland Fire Service said. Colorado Governor Jared Polis declared a disaster emergency response to the fire, authorizing the Colorado National Guard to support response efforts. Washington. President Donald Trump said Sunday on social media that work will begin in September to overhaul Washington's East Potomac golf links, promising to transform the century-old public golf course into the best in the world. Ukraine war. President Vladimir Putin said Sunday that Russia needed greater anti-aircraft capacity to confront Ukrainian drone strikes on oil infrastructure, but added that the country was coping well with the problems the attacks caused. He said Russia would not allow the Ukrainian strikes to detract from Moscow's plans to advance on the front lines. France. 11 people, a pilot and 10 parachutists, were killed when a small plane crashed Sunday in the northeastern French town of Tremblay, narrowly missing nearby homes, as their families watched, officials and a witness said. The aircraft, which was used by a parachuting school, carried 5 trainee parachutists and 5 instructors. European heat wave is worst ever. Temperatures hit 104 degrees Sunday in parts of Europe as storms moved into other areas, with France reporting 1,000 excess heat deaths during the record-breaking heat wave. The French Public Health Agency said most of the heat-related fatalities involved older people and warned the number was about to rise as more details become available about deaths in residential care and private homes. Scientists said the heat wave, which began June 20th, was the worst ever recorded in Europe, and the blistering conditions disrupted power generation, damaged infrastructure, and overwhelmed healthcare systems. Right now, 150 million people are living under extreme heat. Hundreds have died. Schools are shut. Grids are buckling, said the World Health Organization director. Driven by climate change and global warming, the phenomenon of the once-in-a-generation heat wave is now occurring nearly annually. We were warned, he wrote, adding that Europe's homes, workplaces, and schools are ill-equipped for extreme heat. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Pantograph from Monday, June 29th, 2026. Please stay tuned.